I am so shamed and they hate me. A lot of times that's our own stuff.
Are you overwhelmed by motherhood and barely keeping your head above water? Are you confused and frustrated by how all the other moms make it look so easy? You can't figure out how to manage the chaos in your mind, your home, or your family. I get you, Mama. Parenting with ADHD is hard. Here is your permission slip to let go of the Pinterest-worthy visions of organization and structure fit for everyone else. Let's do life like our brains do life, creatively, lovingly, and with all our might. When we embrace who we are and how our brains work, we can figure out how to live our lives successfully, and in turn, lead our families well. At the end of the day, we just want to be good moms, but spoiler alert, you are already a great mom. ADHD does not mean you're doomed to be a hot mess, Mama. You can rewrite your story from shame spiral to success story. And I'll be right here beside you to cheer you on. Welcome to Motherhood in ADHD.
Hey there, successful mama. It's your friend, Patricia Sung. Today's guest is Dr. Han Ren, who is a licensed clinical and school psychologist, consultant, speaker, educator, and mom with ADHD, just like us. Now, Dr. Han's work is deeply rooted in liberation and anti-oppressive work, practicing from a justice-oriented, interpersonal, and systems-informed framework. She is using social media to make therapy more accessible and applicable to our everyday lives. Dr. Han is addressing the pursuit of collective healing through her work and activism centered in historically overlooked communities. Now, I've been watching Dr. Han for quite some time on Instagram, and I love what she's doing. I love how she is yelling with a megaphone, which probably feels like yelling into a void, about what it is like to be a woman of color from her perspective. And I know she gets a ton of grumpy and unkind messages back. And as a community who is fighting for better treatment of those of us with ADHD and mental health issues and disabilities, I also want us to be a community that's fighting for women, that's fighting for mothers, that's fighting for people of color. Like, I want us to be championing everyone, because our community is so widespread and so all-encompassing. Like, we know that ADHD affects people at the same rate, regardless of geography, location, social background, culture. Like, it doesn't matter. ADHD affects everyone. And so if our community looks like this melting pot, then it is my opinion that we also should be championing for everyone in the group, no matter what they look like, feel like, sound like. So when I see someone like Han, who is so beautifully fighting for people who look different and are treated different in our world, I can't help but want to be there to cheer them on. So we do talk about how culture and race affect our ADHD. And we wander through a lot of different areas, including how do we know we should be in therapy? How do we choose a therapist? How does she view her motherhood, considering that she has ADHD? And also navigating friendship. That's hard for us as well. So I can't wait to introduce you to our new friend, Dr. Han Ren. Okay, mamas, let's welcome Dr. Han Ren to the show. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
It's funny to talk to somebody who's actually not that far away. Like, normally I'm interviewing people on the other side of the world or the other country, and we're actually only a couple hours apart. So actually my husband's in Austin today.
Oh, awesome.
Very involved in UT. So he's there a lot. So where I wanted to start was just with your diagnosis journey, because you said something that really hit home when we were going back and forth. And so I was like, ooh, must dive in. So can you just walk us through, like, how did you figure out you had ADHD and what did that look like? And I know it's a very long and winding story for all of us, but the short version of it, but how did you find out?
As a child, I was always very daydreamy and spacey. Teachers would call on me while I was totally not paying attention, but I was always able to compensate for it. I always could pick up whatever it was and did well on tests and very much powered through my schooling. Even through college, I did a lot of kind of like brute force focusing. And then after college, I started grad school. And, you know, in college, you like get some friends who give you some study aids. And I'm like, wow, this is really really helpful. Like, maybe I can like get some study aids for real. So I went to a psychiatrist who was like, actually, yeah, you have ADHD. And I'm like, yes, I fooled them. I was convinced that I had fooled the psychiatrist, tricked them into giving me a prescription for stimulants. And the way that it showed up at that point is if I wasn't interested in something, I would just fall asleep. Like, I just could not keep myself awake, and it was embarrassing. And I would like pinch myself to try to stay awake to the point of like having bruises. And I just could not get myself to get it together. So once I started taking them, and I wasn't even doing it regularly because I was still very convinced that I'd fooled my psychiatrist, I noticed how much of a difference it made, especially in some classes. So it's definitely like a PRN as needed thing for a while. And as I learned more about ADHD in women and ADHD in adulthood, and as I kind of matured into my body and brain and identity, it became more and more apparent that these personality quirks that I had were really not just personality quirks. I always said, oh, I have hobby ADHD because I like to start a lot of projects and, you know, not finish them. And then realize later, oh, it's part of the bigger constellation. And so it really was leaning into it as I matured and became more comfortable with the idea of this diagnosis, because there's just so much that wasn't known about it when I was growing up.
How did you feel in those times where you're like processing it and realizing like, oh, this isn't just quirky me? It is part of the ADHD bubble. Like, what were the feelings going through as it all, like the pieces started coming together?
It's a, you know, combination of like validation and feeling seen, but also like terror. Like, what do I do with this information? How will this affect the way that I live my life? Am I, you know, and it's still just like the self-gaslighting. Am I faking it? I must be faking it. So it really, I think it's still coming in pieces even now of learning to embrace neurodivergence as a gift and one of the many quirks and just diversities of the human experience and the human mind, and not placing any value judgments on, you know, one way or another. Everyone approaches life differently.
So the thing that stood out with me when you said, like, I felt like I tricked my psychiatrist. I hear that from so many moms, like to the point where it's like, okay, why do we feel this way? Because I felt that way too. Of like, why do we feel like we don't actually have the thing we have? I mean, because you work with a lot of people who have ADHD, so yeah. A pretty good pool to gather data from. Why do we feel that way?
I mean, I think for me, and I think, you know, for people of color, a lot of it is this cultural element. You know, it's like children of immigrants, like we are taught that you just have to power through and you have to work harder. And if there's anything that's hard about your life, it's because you're not trying it enough. And that was such a mentality that I grew up with. And so it was very much like, well, I don't look like the 7-year-old white boy who has ADHD, you know, like the jumping out of their seat, the squirminess, like that was never me. And even being a psychologist, you know, unearthing the very many different ways that it shows up in girls, in women, many different ways it shows up in adulthood, and then really navigating the overlap between complex trauma and ADHD. And they don't cause each other, but there is such an overlap because of how trauma affects the brain and how it allows the emergence of some of this neurodivergence to show up at different times. And so it's so hard to parse these things out that it's easy to just believe the conditioning that it's a character flaw.
When you're talking about like having that cultural background, like you need to try harder. How are some of the ways that ADHD gets affected by our culture and our race? Like, how do they all influence each other? I know that's a huge question, but like, can we dive a little more into that?
Yeah. I mean, I think the bigger question is how does different cultures approach neurodivergence, mental illness, and anything that is a deviation from, you know, how a person should be? And then vice versa, how does Western psychology and psychiatry perceive deviances that may be rooted in culture and, you know, but there's such a interactional, transactional dynamic going on, because Western psychology does tend to pathologize a lot of things that are culturally rooted and, you know, along the spectrum of typicality, whatever that means, right? Of just the human condition, human experience. And then vice versa, you have all of these norms from culture that prescribe what is, you know, a problem, what is worth treating, and the stigma that treatment entails.
Right. Well, you said the word pathologized. Some of us won't know what that means. Can you explain that term to us?
Yeah, it means, you know, making it into a disease, a problem, an illness, making it into a diagnosis.
When we look at any group that's different, you're getting this message of you need to fit in. Mm-hmm. When you have ADHD, we tend not to be very good at that. How does that affect who we are and how we're becoming as people when we're getting this message of you need to fit in because it's not safe if you don't fit in, and yet I'm not fitting in?
I mean, for me personally, I think I really embrace being the oddball or just odd, right? Like even within the circles that I hung out with in high school, like I had a lot of like theater goth friends. But like, I think part of ADHD and the way that it manifests for some people is that with friend groups, we can be very much satellites instead of having like, okay, this is my core group of friends. And so that was a gift in a lot of ways that I could like contort and fit myself into lots of different groups. But I also didn't feel like I had like my people in quite the same way. Like I had one or, you know, several close friends, but not like a group. And that met the needs of different parts of my identity and different parts of my personality. But it was never like, okay, you are totally along the lines of like the nerdy kids or the, you know, theater kids or whatever, because there were so many elements of how I presented that were not consistent with whatever group I was hanging with. And so I really adapted by just having lots of different groups.
I think as a mom, especially when you have ADHD kids, that's something you worry a lot about is, will my kids have strong friendships? Is it okay for our kids to just have one or two friends, or do they need that core group of people?
One or two friends is great. One or two friends is so solid. Most people don't have just like that solid few friends, you know? And I do think like when we find our people, like they are our people. They love you for who you are, and you can latch on and really get each other. And so sometimes it's quality over quantity, it's depth, but also a lot of times, you know, and I think it depends on the person, but for me, I felt that I was like too much for one group, right? So then I could like spend some time here and then spend some time there. And so like, it was like, okay, well, I don't have to like overwhelm any like group of people. So I did have like my solid crew who I'm still solid with, you know, 20 years later. But then with the groups of people that I hung out with, it was like a relief to feel like I don't have to be too much. You know, you won't get sick of me because I can diversify or like make myself scarce if I get the sense that like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm becoming too much. This is too intense.
I think that's a feeling that a lot of people with ADHD have, is that feeling of I'm too much. And we don't notice that it's too much until it's too late. And it's like, oh, that was too much.
And the shame.
And then the shame spiral starts and like the recoil of like, okay, well now I'm just going to go hide and I'll just avoid that person for X amount of time to like balance out the too muchness with the absence and maybe like evens out. Mm-hmm. And then we like, okay, now I'm being a bad friend because I was away too long. And there's this like constant self-doubt and this pendulum swing of like too much, too little. Like, what is your advice to moms who are feeling like all I do is swing between too much and non-existent?
It's so normal, right? Like the too much, not enough. Like, and it happens in romantic relationships and partnerships too, of this, like, you know, I think of attachment as like this, like undulation of waves of like, okay, now we're coming back together. Now we're coming back apart again. And you know, it's normal. And I think like we have this idea that as humans, we just need to be so hyper consistent, or like people are not going to be forgiving of us, or, you know, but everyone is doing this. And sometimes you like, you know, have this like synergy when you guys are like aligned, and sometimes you don't. And that's just life. And there's no reason or need to judge or shame that. You know, if it doesn't work and you find yourself in this like, oops, too much, not enough space, okay, try again. You know, that's the gift of relationships. It's not about the rupture, it's about the repair. And being able to repair, I think, is an ADHD gift, because we have to do it a lot. So, you know, normalizing that.
How can we hone in that skill of repair? How can we be better repairers? Because we do a lot of repairing. What are the ways that we can do that better?
I think part of it is noticing what's your own like rejection sensitivity, you know, and what's like the actual thing. And we're not going to always know, but most of the time we're like, oh my gosh, I am so shamed and they hate me. A lot of times that's our own stuff. And we have this desire to just go hide under a rock and avoid and never talk to that person again. Or like, are you mad at me? Are you mad at me? I'm so sorry. Or, you know, like the peppering of anxiety questions. And I think building that self-awareness of when we're in that space of like, okay, let's ground, let's center, let's regulate. And then let's check in. It's like, hey, you know, this might be just me, but that interaction we had, I came away from it feeling a little self-conscious or like fearful that I might have said something or overstepped in some ways. Can we talk about it? And just framing it as a question. It's a conversation. And, you know, sometimes people are a little taken aback because that's not how we tend to communicate. We're not as direct as I think we really need to be in interpersonal relationships. But then the more you normalize that and the more you start those conversations, the more people can meet you there. And, you know, that builds connection, that builds closeness over time, where you can just like, hey, was that too much? Yes. Okay, cool. I'm really sorry. Now I know. Or no, it wasn't. Okay. Thank you for validating me. I was in my head. That's it. And then if it was too much, okay, what was it? What can I do next time? I'll try to remember. Maybe it won't really, you know, maybe it's going to take a few repetitions. And that's okay. And that's part of loving yourself too, as you learn to like embrace this quirkiness in how you show up in the world. The more you love yourself, the more other people will also be able to love you. And then you normalize that for them. They can love themselves too. We need to show up imperfectly, because that's the only way we can be authentic.
So shifting gears, you do a lot of therapy with people who have ADHD.
Yes.
How do we know it is time to seek out the help of a therapist?
I think I'm biased because I think everybody could benefit from therapy. You don't have to be in a place of crisis or despair. It depends on your specific experience and presentation, but for a lot of ADHDers, we do best when we have a sounding board. Like, we can't formulate the jumble of thoughts in our heads to make sense. So we need somebody to like listen and just reflect. You know, being able to talk it through helps us organize our own thoughts. I mean, that's one of the beauties of journaling. But you don't have somebody else to like untangle that ball of yarn alongside you. I think if you wonder like, could this be helpful? Give it a shot. What do you have to lose? And I recognize that it's a privilege and inaccessible for lots of different reasons for many. And if it's within your accessibility, or you can rearrange something to just give it a shot, please do. Because I have seen so many people feel this immense relief in, you know, having their experiences normalized and having somebody else bear witness to their pain.
How do we know that we're picking the right person for us to be our therapist?
Oh, that's such a great question. You get to interview them too. Like, you know, there's usually like a free consult call. Most therapists offer that. And that's a time that you can get a feel for how this conversation flows. You ask them questions about the characteristics that are important to you in a therapist. Is it experience with this particular diagnosis problem? Or is it, you know, lived experience where this person shares common identity characteristics as you? Is this person just like funny and nurturing? You just like jive on a personality level? Like all of those factors are really important. And, you know, sometimes you can't get all of that information in just like a 15-minute call. If you start with a therapist, give it like 5 sessions, feel it out, see how it goes. And if after 5 sessions, you're like, I don't feel comfortable, I don't feel safe, or I feel like they're bored or they're not interested or in tune, then try somebody else. It's a lot like dating. You got to, you know, interview them and you got to suss them out, because it's an intimate relationship. And it's a very, very important one.
As a therapist, do you also have a therapist?
Oh, of course. Yes, absolutely. I have been in therapy on and off since I was 14. And I've been through all sorts of different therapy modalities, relationships. I've been couples therapy, my daughter's in therapy. And for the past, gosh, like since I started my own independent practice, and I was like, ooh, I need someone to like walk alongside me. So like for the past 5 years, I've just been in weekly therapy.
A lot of them are not really sure, like, what do I do in therapy? Like what actually happens when I'm there? Can you walk us through? Like, so it's like, it's more approachable. They're like, okay, I already know what I'm getting into. Here's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm.
And that's so different depending on the therapist and the modality and the type of therapy you're getting. And so there are some therapists who are like, okay, we're going to work on skills. Like, let's make an agenda for the day. And here's a worksheet. And some people really respond to that because they feel like they need that structure. What I have discovered is that, you know, oftentimes that's really great for the beginning stages of like, okay, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to do this. And then you learn it. But eventually you get to a point where like, okay, now I know what I should be doing, but I'm not doing it. Why? Right? Like that's where I feel like, ooh, this is fun. Like this is like the real like relational work. There's real like templating, the dismantling work comes in. And I think like, as long as you have a solid relationship with your therapist where you feel seen and understood and nurtured and safe, that's their job. The therapist's job is to conceptualize, guide, and like meet you where you are. You don't have to, you know, carry that burden and labor. And I have gone through different types of therapy throughout my life. You know, some are very like cognitive, behavioral, head-based, and some are very like somatic, body-centered. Some are very emotion-centered. And depending on where I was in my own readiness, different modalities have worked well for me accordingly. I think where I am now, like I know what I can or should be doing most of the time, but there are still things that get in my way. And that's all the like deeper work, all the childhood understanding, unraveling, dismantling. And so, you know, one of the things that I think is really helpful for my own therapy, but also how I approach work with my clients is this question of, where did you learn that? How did it serve you then? And does it still serve you now? What is the function of this for you? And a lot of that stuff is not just the content of like, this was my week. It's the process of like, what's happening in the room, in the here and now, like between us, does that show up somewhere else? Can we talk about it? And that's like the, ooh, it's so vulnerable, but it's also like, you can't hide or run from it when it is in the room with you. And you know, someone's pointing that out.
Yeah. I think we're all carrying on so much baggage that the thought of even entering the room and being like, I have baggage, like just that first step feels so scary. So yeah. To know that when you're looking for help, there are many different options out there. There are many different people. You have so many choices. And like you said, it's like dating. You have to try out all the different things. It's like, you know what? I went on this date and this person, when we got sushi, turns out I don't really like sushi, but I would still like that person if we tried Italian. And you're like, it's like all the different pieces can come together. And the whole point is for you to feel safe and comfortable working through your baggage. Comforting to hear, like, there are lots of choices. So if one person doesn't work out, you can talk to another one. If one type doesn't work out, you can try a different thing.
And that's so normal. You know, I want to normalize the like process of finding a therapist and like trying out different types of therapy. Like sometimes you do a good piece of work with a therapist for however long, a year, 2 years. And then you're like, okay, that part is done. And then you're ready to start a new relationship with somebody else. You know, as a therapist, like I take people to a certain point and then maybe somebody else will pick it up along the way. And some people, I take them longer in their journey, some people I don't. And wherever I may take them is self-discovery. It's a journey. Even if they hate me, it's like, okay, now you know what you don't like. That's awesome. It's not personal to me. And I don't take it personally.
Do you wish there was a way to feel like you're not failing at life and motherhood every day? I know what it's like to run around all day like a headless chicken, stressed because you're late to everything, and when you finally sit down after the kids are in bed, you think about how you didn't get anything done, and somehow your to-do list is longer than when you started out this morning. You're tired, drowning, and feel like you'll never catch up. But imagine this. When you sit down at the end of the night, there's no Mount Laundry. You know what's for dinner. You spend some quality time with your kids, and Medusa Mom didn't even rear her ugly head at bedtime. And you did something kind just for yourself today. If you did even one of those things today, you'd be thrilled, right? It's not a fairy tale, Mama. There are other moms with ADHD getting their days together, and you can too. That's why I created Time Management Mastery for ADHD Moms, where I teach you how to create a rhythm for your day in an ADHD-friendly way that puts the lengthy to-do list of motherhood on automate, so you don't have to think about when you'll sleep next or how you'll find time to pay that bill you've been putting off. You'll be able to make a plan for your day that is fluid enough for your ADHD brain to stick with, but structured enough to feel like you're in control. Remember, our rhythms and routines serve us, not the other way around. Over the next 11 weeks, you will create a flexible framework for your day and walk away with a community of moms who understand you and are cheering you on and say, I'm right there with you. Because being a mom is hard. We will get off track. That's just part of ADHD. But now you will have the support to get back on track when you are struggling. We meet weekly to help us remember, oh yeah, we're working on a goal. Most importantly, you'll learn about how your ADHD brain works, so that you make decisions from a place of confidence. Because a healthy mama leads a healthy family. Being proactive comes from a place of strength, which takes a ton of strain off your relationships because you are in a better place. When you're ready to lighten your load by making a daily plan and figuring out what makes sense for your ADHD brain and enjoying more of your motherhood, it's time to sign up for the Time Management Mastery for ADHD Moms program. The next round of the program is starting soon, so hop on over to the waitlist at bit.ly/TMM waitlist. That's bit.ly/TMM, that's for Time Management Mastery, WAITLIST, all lowercase letters, so that you'll be the first one to know when it's ready. And I always have a little something special for the mamas who have a vote of confidence for me before the program is ready to open. So head over and sign up for that waitlist, because the program's starting soon and now's the time to make a change in your daily life. One more time, that's bit.ly/TMM waitlist.
I think a lot of women with ADHD are very afraid of breaking up with their therapist. Like, what if I actually do go in and then I realize I don't want to do it anymore? Or like you said, like we've completed that thing and it's time to do a different thing. Like, how do we break up with our therapist?
Please don't ghost us. Sometimes if your therapist is causing you harm and you don't want to go back, you can like send them an email and say, this is why, right? But for the most part, saying goodbye is just as important as saying hello. And it is something that as a society, we're not good at. We're non-confrontational. Like women with ADHD, we're very bad at saying goodbye because it brings up all of this uncomfortable feelings. You have to sit with your own like sadness or your own like, oh, am I hurting you? Am I offending you? And if you can do that in the therapeutic relationship, wow, find out what you can do in the world, in your life. Like, you know, everything you do with your therapist is like a trial run. You generalize that skill to somewhere else in your life. And so practicing being assertive and clear communication, and then your therapist facilitates that, ideally. I mean, if you're breaking up with a therapist, they might not be the safest person to facilitate that, but then you also practice like, hey, this is not meeting my needs and it's not personal and it doesn't have to be something that you feel so much shame about. It'll probably be uncomfortable, probably be hard. And it's great practice for life. And we're used to it too. You know, it doesn't always feel good, especially when we're kind of blindsided by it. And that's why it's like, okay, please don't ghost us so we can have a conversation about it. Your job is not to educate me or like give me feedback, but if that would feel good to you, please do. But I would like to facilitate as much closure and completion for you as possible, because that is part of how we grow as humans.
And I think remember that no therapist expects you to stay with them for the entirety of your lifespan. Like, that's not a realistic expectation. So it's expected that at some point you're going to do something different, whether that is you're taking a break, whether it is you want to try something new, whether it is you want to tackle a different problem that maybe that person's not the right fit for. Like, it's okay. You're allowed
to. Yeah. Or you move, or your job changes, so your insurance doesn't cover. You know, those are kind of like naturalistic breakup points. And somehow those feel a little easier or more accessible, but they don't have to be the only reason why people end their therapeutic relationships. And for a lot of my clients, you know, after a while, it's like, okay, you know, things are going really well. Do we want to scale it back? Do you want to do biweekly, once a month? Or, you know, we have booster sessions every few months, and or just come back when you need me. I'm here. Life will happen. And go off and live your life. And if you need me, I'm here.
Okay, I'm going to switch gears again.
Yeah.
When you think about your motherhood and having ADHD, how do you approach things differently in your life now that you know you have ADHD?
I want to believe that I'm more patient and I give more grace. I think I give more grace to my children than I do to myself. I think that's still something that I am working on and learning and unlearning. I know the value and necessity of a good Google Calendar, a solid, like, write things down, put them in the calendar, and everyone looks at the family calendar, the work calendar. You know, like, I live and die by my calendar. I need it. And then I also like keep notes on my phone. I will put, you know, task lists on, but I will also like jot down ideas that I have for different things. Cause like ideas strike me at the most random times. And if I don't capture it, it'll just be gone. So I'm in the process of learning how to just like capture it as they come up. Because before I would think like, oh yeah, I'll remember it later. And no, I won't.
No, that is one of the biggest ADHD lies. I will remember that later, or I will do that later.
Nope. And you know, another thing is like, as a mother, your time is so precious. And you know that if you don't do that thing now, because you like really don't feel like it, it'll probably just never get done. So if it's going to take 5 minutes or less, just do the thing. Just force yourself to do the thing. And I hate it, but I was like, okay, just you folded the laundry, just put it away. Otherwise you will not put it away and you'll just live out of your laundry basket for the rest of the week, which is fine. But if you can, just put it away. And another part, it's like being okay with living out of the laundry basket. And you can see my bookshelf behind me. It is not organized. And just being okay with that.
But the funny thing is, I didn't even look at your bookshelf. You know, like, I noticed there is a bookshelf and I saw there were books. But like, to me, I didn't notice that it wasn't organized. So you're like, look at my unorganized bookshelf. But I think that's something we do a lot, is we say like, oh, don't mind this mess. And it's like, well, oh, well, now I see your mess. Whereas before, like, I didn't even notice the mess. And we're far more self-conscious of what our mess is than a lot of people.
That's like the personality quirk, right? That you think is just like a personality quirk. And you're like, oh gosh, I'm just really neurotic. And also like, you know, the rejection sensitivity, the like self-consciousness, like it extends beyond adolescence. Like, for a lot of people, it's like in your teen years, it's super hypersensitive. And then you're like, oh, okay, whatever. But for us, kind of sticks around.
Like, what parts of ADHD are the hardest for you? Like, where are the areas where you really struggle most?
I get bored. I get bored so easily. And I am really learning to roll with that and to just do the things that my energy wants me to do. Because if I'm feeling something, like, I will get into a flow and I will love that thing. But even as I'm like in my career, I always start something like, I will love this forever. And then I realize as I'm into like, okay, and I'm done with that. And I'm ready to do that, something else. And so it's like, you know, I have so many like craft hobbies that I've go through the period, my macrame phase. I have all this macrame. Okay. My crochet phase. These days I'm into like punch embroidery. But you know, even with like, with my career, I did a lot of clinical work for the first few years. I was like, I'm building a practice. I'm like, okay, maybe I want to do some assessments. And then I'm like, oh, I'm going to start a TikTok. And so like, I realize that I have to go where the energy flows and where it takes me. And so, you know, in recent times, I've really scaled back on my clinical work because I've noticed it wasn't nourishing and energizing me in quite the same way. And I'm, you know, doing more speaking and switching gears a little bit. And because this is where my interest is, I've been trying to write a book for a long time and I've been really trying to like force it. And then, you know, forcing it doesn't work. I'm feeling like more of that flow. So maybe it'll happen this year, but I'm also really learning to just ride the wave of wherever my interests take me, because when it works, it really, really works. And when it doesn't, forget it.
Yeah, that's a really hard one for us, of like being okay with being the switcher. Because we do get the lesson, oh, what happened to that macrame? And everyone's like giving you the side eye of like, oh, is this just like your, I'm going to be a crochet businesswoman and sell all my crochet wares. And now we're on to whatever, you know, thing it is. And that it starts to cut in. At the same time, forcing yourself to do something that you really don't enjoy.
It's not it.
Where are we going with this? We're not getting anything out of that anymore. And it's hard to reconcile those two things.
It's okay to quit. I think that's something we don't normalize or talk about enough in our society. You know, like, we don't have good celebratory language for people who know when to quit before it gets miserable. We have like, you know, say like grit and perseverance for people who like keep on doing something that they don't want to do for what? For the sake of completion? Yeah, ride the waves of your own energy levels. And when you do quit, your energy will show you something else. You will find something else that will be very interesting and give you that flow and feel great. And you do that for a while and then you do something else. It's okay.
But it reminds me of a lot of people who start things like, maybe you start grad school or like something that's going to take you multiple years to complete. And you get towards the end and you're like, I don't want to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And people are like, well, we'll just finish because then you have your degree. It's like, well, okay, yes, but what are you going to do with that degree that you don't want to do?
Yeah. I mean, as someone who went to a lot of school, I definitely know how that feels. And you know, yeah, there were definitely times I wanted to quit during my grad school years. But I also knew that the freedom of having this degree was worth it. And that's another thing. It's like, people think like, okay, you get this degree in this thing and then that's all you can do with it. But actually, like, school or graduate degrees or whatever, like, the ability to learn proves that you can learn. And so I am doing way different things with my PhD than I ever thought I would be doing. And that's really cool. And I get to continue seeing where that goes.
And it's hard in the moment to think about both sides, to know, like, is this really the thing I should push through and finish because I can take it other places? Or is this the thing that's making me miserable and I need to let it go? And hey, that's what you go to therapy for.
Someone else helps you figure that out. Yeah. And, you know, I actually think grad school is not a terrible thing for a lot of people with ADHD, because you do lots of different things in grad school. And especially my program, it was like a professional research program. So I did a lot of clinical work. I did a lot of research. I did a lot of reading and theory. And so that really stimulated this part of my brain that needs novelty and sensation and change. If I hated something, it was a semester long. Okay. And then I could be done with it. And sometimes it was, yeah, it was some powering through that I have learned and trained myself from my childhood. But that's when it came in handy, because I knew I could do something else soon enough.
And a lot of people will say, like, how can you have ADHD if you have a graduate degree, or you are a medical doctor, or you are a lawyer? But it's like, well, school is designed to change every semester. So you're constantly getting something new, but also you generally speaking, choose something that you really like, love and enjoy. So of course you're interested and do well in that. So it's this,
you have to pick the right program. You have to know yourself well enough to pick the right program.
It's funny how we get these like oxymorons of ADHD of like, you can't focus, but yet somehow you got a lottery. Like,
I mean, it's also structure, right? We need that structure. Like, I don't do well if I just try to structure my own time. I'll do nothing and become really depressed. I need some external structure and a kick in the butt sometimes, and someone else to help me hold myself accountable.
I was speaking of being depressed and this whole pandemic thing, in this last couple of years, you started this TikTok and it took off. Like, why did that start? And how do you see that molding where you're going now?
It started kind of as a joke, because my daughter would watch TikToks with her dad every night. And, you know, so I'd be always like, what is that thing? And, you know, I would see them like interact. It was such a fun thing. And I knew that there were therapists on the app. So I went in and looked at some of it, and I was like, wow, this is like very basic. Like, I can do this. And then I realized, like, these are people who tend to be white and attractive and talking about like 5 signs you have anxiety, 4 coping skills for depression, you know, like middle of the road types of content around mental health, which is important and necessary. And I was realizing that there's a whole community that's being left out of these conversations, you know, marginalized people, you know, people of color, and really not talking about the intersection of systemic systems of oppression and mental health. And that was something that I was already interested in doing the work in my own clinical work and, you know, other spaces that I was occupying. I'm like, okay, I'm going to talk about this. And then my daughter was like, well, if you can get 1,000 followers by the end of your first month, I'll buy you a cake. And so I like stepped it up, and she didn't buy me a cake because she got salty, but that's okay. I ended up with more than 1,000 followers by the end of the first month. And I was like, okay, there's a hunger for this. And I mean, just like everything with energy flows, like it ebbs and flows. Sometimes I really want to do it, sometimes I don't. And I'm learning to be okay with that. And I really think of this as like, gosh, I can change what I talk about. I have this platform. I have this attention of a lot of people who are invested in me. And that means I can be multifaceted. I can be ADHD and get bored and talk about this for a while, then talk about that for a while. And that's okay. And I think that's really, really cool, because I try to be relatable, and I am excited about where it could possibly take me. I don't know. I don't know where it's going to take me.
Well, one of the things I love is that you do talk about the things that are not in that like middle solid, like it just feels very vanilla of like, yes, we do all need coping skills for anxiety. But like your video, it was like affirmations for horrible times. And you're doing the like that, I don't even know what it's called.
The drop challenge. Yes.
Thank you. The drop challenge. And it's like, and your affirmations made me laugh so hard, because, you know, we're always being told with age, like, oh, try meditation and affirmations and all this stuff. And your affirmations were just so like spot on, like it was like snarky, but yet like, I can get behind this. I can get behind like, today sucks, but it'll be better. I'm like, you said it better than I did, but I love that it is so relatable, and it feels like I'm not just getting the like silver lining, mental health is great kind of a talk. And it's that being okay with saying like, yeah, this time's really hard, especially for moms, especially for those with ADHD, anybody who's, I was like, anybody, everybody who has extra baggage they're carrying around right now, where this doesn't look like what we thought our lives were going to look like right now. And it still doesn't. Like, the length of it is heavy when it continues on. Just so, I so appreciate your.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been really cool to kind of have like a finger on the pulse of the cultural zeitgeist of our times. And I've really felt that. I mean, for a certain cross section, you know, I definitely acknowledge the privilege of the scope and lens that I have. But I think one of the things that I noticed really resonate is, if I can summarize that moment, that zeitgeist for people, I mean, just across my clients, like, okay, I'm noticing these patterns. Everyone's having issues with friendships right now. Everyone's feeling a lot of rage right now. And then being able to summarize and normalize that for people, like, that has been really powerful. And I think people connect and feel reassured. I'm not alone. It's not just me.
Yeah. And that's why I started the podcast. There are so many moms out there who have ADHD or have it and don't even know. Mm-hmm. And having that ability to say, like, it's okay that you're struggling with this thing. And there are actually thousands, if not millions, of other people, whether or not they're moms who have ADHD or not, that are also feeling like this. And you're not by yourself. There are other people who are dealing with all that, all these suitcases as well. Like, you can't see me on the podcast, so I'm doing all these like motions of suitcases as we're talking. Okay. What's one thing you're really proud of accomplishing, considering that you have ADHD?
This goes beyond ADHD. This is my whole life mission. A big part of what motivates me is that I don't want to traumatize my kids. It's the identity of being a cycle breaker. They're, you know, like, I pretty much got a doctorate in parenting and child psychology because I want to do right by my kids. And I knew from a very young age, like, I want to have children and I want to give them a different experience. And as my kids are growing and, you know, becoming who they are, it's so beautiful and like tender and vulnerable to see the ways that they relate to themselves, their experiences in the world around them that is not colored in shame and deficit. And that is something that I feel so proud of just as a human, and a clinician and a mom in all the ways. And it is absolutely possible and probable. You just really have to have that self-reflection, that self-awareness. Because most of the time, if we're really struggling with something parenting related, it's just as much about us as it is about whatever's going on in our kids. There are mirrors.
Before we do our lightning round, will you tell the mamas how they can find you and connect with you if they're like, oh, I gotta learn more?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram and TikTok as Dr. Han Ren. And you can also go to my website, drhanren.com.
All right, lightning round. You don't have to explain anything. You just fill in the blank. Number one, the best thing that I've read or listened to recently is?
What My Bones Know by Stephanie Fu. New book.
Number two, my most boring about me fact is?
I don't know why. This is such a brain stumper for me. I need routine. I mean, I guess it's boring, but I need structure and routine. And I am learning to give that to myself when in the absence of other external factors.
Number three, when I'm having a rough day, my go-to quote, song, poem, book, activity, whatever is?
Exercise. Yeah, I need to get that sweat in and it really helps. Like a good dance groove, like solid beat drop.
Number four, don't tell anyone
I'm very bad at cleaning my house.
And now there's all the moms, amen. Number five, if I had a magic fairy wand for one spell, I would
get out of my own head.
Okay. And the last one, number six, my best piece of advice for mamas with ADHD is?
Go with the flow. Just go with the flow. You'll get further than trying to fight it. It's a gift. It's part of who you are. It's beautiful. It's messy. Ride that wave.
For more resources, classes, and community, head over to my website, motherhoodinadhd.com.